and pull these presentation materials down, and I'm going to turn it over to Kent Glover, who is the FRTR Steering Committee Chair, to get things started. So Kent, let me spotlight your video and turn it over to you, sir.
Welcome to the Fall 2021 meeting of the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable. Last May at the spring meetings, senior leaders from many agencies repeatedly identified climate resilience techniques and technologies as a major challenge and need for their agencies. So when planning started for this meeting, it was clear that we needed to take a closer look at the topic in order to better understand really three things. First, the need for advancing technology of climate resilience in our cleanup efforts. Second, where our agencies are in addressing the needs with the expectation that no one agency would have all the answers, but we all have a contribution to make. And third, to learn how FRTR can contribute to the efforts through our interagency collaboration and technology transfer. So the fall meeting of FRTR focuses, as Jean indicated, on remedy protectiveness and climate resiliency in site cleanups. Well, we don't expect these meetings to provide definitive answers to site resilience questions. They're complicated and will take some time to work out, I'm sure. However, our goal for this meeting is to ask the right questions and learn where we can find reliable information to help us answer them. And to do this, we've assembled a robust agenda and some excellent speakers for the two meetings, first one today and then next Monday as well. To start us off, I'd like to introduce Dr. Carlton Waterhouse. He is the Deputy Assistant Administrator of the EPA Office of Land and Emergency Management. He's a widely recognized expert in environmental law and environmental justice. He's had a distinguished career at EPA and also is a law professor at Howard University. He holds a PhD from Emory University and a JD from Howard. And so join me in welcoming Dr. Waterhouse.
Thank you so much for those comments, Kent. I really appreciate it. And thank you and welcome everyone. I'm so glad to be here together as a federal family in particular, so that we can be together at this virtual session of the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable. The hosting of the meeting is typically rotated through member agencies, and this fall, our turn at EPA came up. As a Deputy Assistant Administrator for OLM, it's therefore my pleasure and honor to welcome everyone to both today's session and the second part of this meeting that's being held on Monday, November the 15th. As the roundtable is now embarking on its fourth decade as a valuable forum to exchange information and leverage knowledge on advances in site cleanup practice, I want to emphasize that the role of innovation and application of advances in the technologies for characterization, remediation, and monitoring continue to be essential to our federal efforts to address the cleanup challenges the member agencies face. Such a vibrant and forward-looking exchange and a positive collaboration it fosters are at the root of good public administration. And I want to take a moment just to recognize how wonderful it is to be together as a federal family with so many different agencies that are collaborating closely to make sure that we're all learning from each other and working together to make sure that we're using the absolute best technologies that we can in remediation work that we all do. I'm very happy that the Remediation Technologies Roundtable, Roundtable Steering Committee, that is, chose climate resilience as a topic for this meeting. It's very important and it's very timely, as we see. President has directed all agencies in the federal family to integrate climate adaptation planning into our missions, programs, and management functions to ensure their success in enhancing preparedness for and resilience to the climate crisis. My office, the Office of Land and Emergency Management, manages several contaminated site cleanup programs under different statutory authorities. Those include the Superfund Remedial Program, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act Corrective Action Program, and the PCB cleanup program. They are all working together as we speak to identify shared climate vulnerabilities and to identify actions that might be taken to address them. When it comes to cleaning up contaminated sites, that's a common goal we share across all our agencies in the FRTR. We want to ensure the actions we take are protective of human health and the environment, regardless of future climate conditions. Furthermore, contaminated sites are often in or near underburdened and frequently underserved communities. These communities are likely to bear greater risks and burdens from climate-driven extreme events and to have a more difficult time bouncing back or otherwise recovering. Hence the importance of this meeting. The FRTR was established in 1990 to bring together top federal cleanup program managers and other remediation community representatives to share experiences in resolving the complex site cleanup challenges we all face. And the discussion regarding efforts we can make to address climate challenges could not be more timely. Conducting climate vulnerability assessments for site cleanups and building the appropriate level of resilience when and where required is a challenge for all, with many opportunities to share experiences and resources. I want to reiterate this meeting is a very valuable opportunity for us to share this information on such a high priority and an important topic across agencies, to share lessons learned on cleaning up contaminated sites across federal agencies and thereby maximize the return on the billions of federal dollars invested annually to accomplish cleanups. I want to thank the speakers for sharing your insights and experiences. And I want to thank those in the virtual audience for investing your time in learning how we can better build resilience into our site cleanups. I encourage your open participation in this discussion. And I want to now hand back the meeting over to the Roundtable Steering Committee Chair, Kent Glover of the United States Air Force, and the meeting chair, Carlos Pachon of our EPA Office of Superfund Remediation at Technology Innovation. Thank you both, and thank you, everyone.
All right, thank you so very much. I'm just waiting to get Carlos and Kent back on camera, and we'll carry on with the presentation. Carlos, thank you very much. I see you now. Let me turn it back to you.
Thank you, Jean. Let me go ahead and share my slides here. Just a second, please. So bring this up.
Gene, while he's doing that, maybe I should just say something about Carlos.
Please go right ahead.
Yeah, Carlos has a long history with the FRTR, and when this topic came up as a topic of interest to the agencies, everybody immediately turned to Carlos as the person we wanted to have plan this session. And I don't have a resume sitting in front of me for Carlos, but he's well known in our community. So we're really pleased that he was able to take time from his schedule to coordinate this. And it's been the lion's share of the work. A number of people have helped him, but just wanted to say thank you to Carlos before we get too far into it. Carlos.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken. I appreciate that. I'm just getting myself here. I think I'm almost have it up. And I want to share and share screen. And it's going to ask me which one. And I'm going to share this one. Okay. So thank you. Just quick time check. I think we've got a very busy schedule. So today, appreciate your opening comments, Ken and Carlton. Thank you for speaking with us this morning. I want to take a few minutes now to quickly narrow down the discussion to make sure that we're all on the same page as to what the scope of the conversation is with respect to climate change. Climate change is a very broad topic, but even climate change adaptation itself is a pretty broad. So I want to bring it down to what the questions are that we're thinking about here. with respect to climate change. There we go. So there's two key concepts, and I think many of you that are on the call have these in mind or thinking about these as we came into the meeting. The first is a question of climate change mitigation. Climate change mitigation, of course, is the question of how can we achieve our core emissions with a lower environmental footprint, specifically with fewer greenhouse gases. We, as a federal family and other practitioners, have been working on this, often with different names, but we know it as green remediation, where we look at the environmental footprint necessary required to achieve the protective remedies and actions we can take to reduce that footprint, including greenhouse gas emissions. So that's the emission mitigation side of the house. And we expect to see a lot more of that kind of look forward in the next few months from this administration. But today's focus conversation is on climate change adaptation. And the point there is, how do we integrate what we already know about climate changes into our program operations? And that is, basically the outcome of that is resilience. So we take our operations, we check and see what vulnerabilities they have, we adapt them as needed, and we end up with a more resilient system. So that's the main focus of what we are talking about today, climate change in the context of contaminated site cleanups. But there's a further question. There's a broad question for all agencies as to how is climate change likely to affect the ability of the office to achieve its core mission and strategic goals. But we want to ask a more detailed question, and we bring that down to the RPM, the Remedial Project Manager. I'm with the Superfund program, and the RPM is one of our ultimate decision makers in ensuring that sites are cleaned up in a protective way. And the question for them is, how is climate change likely to affect the protectiveness of the remedy, and what should you do about it if there is an issue there? So that's it. Core question I ask all of you to keep in mind, because that's what this meeting is all about, how we ensure that we build and operate protective remedies. We'll look at this in a little bit more detail, but basically this is what we're talking about. Looking at a system, by that we refer to a cleanup system, a remedy. What are the climate exposures it faces? How is climate changing at a location? And what is that remedy's sensitivity to those changes in climate? Having that information, we can then look at if there is a sensitivity in some way that a remedy's performance can be impaired, we might have to look at resilience or adaptation measures we need to take to build resilience into the system. So we look at our options for building resilience, which ones address key sensitivities or get us the biggest return on investment, and we implement those that we deem necessary and cost effective. We then conduct a periodic reassessment throughout the life of the site until we are able to move on from that site. So that's basically the framework, a conceptual framework for looking at sites and remedy effectiveness in climate change. So in these 2 days, these two and a half hour meetings, basically as Kent laid out, we're first going to look at some of the review the state of the federal agency directives and guidance. There's a lot going on. As you know, Executive Order 14008 resulted in a lot of action plans across all federal agencies. A lot of that is playing out. So this meeting is very timely for us to share not only across agencies, but even within agencies about where things are. We also want to share information on federal agency approaches and tools we are using to evaluate our vulnerabilities, assess resilience adaptation needs, and put those in place at site cleanup projects. And then particularly for next Monday, we'll be looking at a few case studies where we demonstrate the steps taken both to assess vulnerabilities as well as to look at remedy protectiveness in light of climate change impacts. So with that said, I'd like to hand it over to Alicia Stenstrom. She is from the Department of Defense. So she's going to give us an umbrella perspective on where the Department of Defense is with respect to building adaptation measures into all programs. So Alicia, please.
Hey, great. Can you all hear me? Okay, let me just
share. Yes, we can.
Okay. And just confirming that you all can see the presentation.
We don't see it up yet. If you could try one more time. There we go. I can see you going into slideshow. Perfect. We see them now.
Thank you so much. Great. So thank you for inviting me here to talk about DoD climate adaptation. My name is Alicia Senstrom, and I'm on detail from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Environment and Energy Resilience on their climate action team. So I arrived in March. I come from the regulatory program in the Army Corps in the New England District. And Carrie Meyer, also on detail from the Army Corps, will be providing sort of an update on the sustainability program mitigation and upcoming EO. Carrie, do you want to introduce yourself? And if not, I can just move forward. Okay, hopefully she'll be able to unmute for her slides. Okay, so this brief will address the following topics. So I'm going to go through an overview of the relevant climate policy directives and authorities, an overview of the climate reports and tools. And so that includes the DoD Climate Adaptation Plan, or CAP, that was released on the 7th of October, the Climate Risk Analysis, or GCRA, released the 21st of October, a companion document to the CAP, which shows highlights and examples of climate adaptation, which was just released on the November 4th, a little bit on the DoD sustainability program and upcoming executive orders. And then some of the tools that I'll touch on are the Defense Climate Assessment Tool, or DCAT, and the DoD Regional Sea Level, or DORSAL, database. And then sort of talk about next steps. So as Carlos just talked about, adaptation, mitigation, and resilience. So you'll see these three words throughout the presentation. As well as climate policies, directives, authorities, reports, and even talking points used by senior leadership throughout the department. So I won't, you know, read through this. Carlos did a great job of sort of talking through them. The graphic on the right there sort of shows how they worked, how mitigation and adaptation work together to build the resilience. And the definitions right there on the bottom are included in the Climate Adaptation Plan, and they're actually defined in DoD Directive 4715.21, Climate Change, Adaptation, and Resilience. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. Okay, so apologies that this is a little crowded, but it really is an overview of the DoD Climate Preparedness and Resilience policies, directives, tools. And so this is sort of everything that I'm going to touch on in just a little bit more detail. So the top left corner there, the chart summarizes DoD requirements related to climate change considerations. So we've got that quadrennial defense review is bullet number one. The climate change adaptation roadmap for 2014, this is actually the climate adaptation plan that was just released, builds upon the actions and activities outlined in this report. And an update is due at the beginning of 2022. Then below that, I just mentioned the DoD Directive 4715.21, Climate Change, Adaptation, and Resilience. This actually provides the framework and roles and responsibilities for climate change within the department. And then you have the more recent National Defense Authorization Acts, NDAAs, 18, 19, and 20, which these all have climate consideration requirements. So one of them being the update to that 2014 roadmap, various reports to Congress on the effects of a changing climate on DoD, as well as some requirements to expand resilience authorities through granting broad authority to fund projects that improve climate resilience on DoD installations. And then we've got a memo from ANS, Acquisition and Sustainment, to improve defense installation resilience to rising sea levels. That was released in 2020. And that requires the department to integrate appropriate planning and design standards that account for projected sea level rise. And then we've got a few more DoD directives and instructions, mission assurance, insulation energy management, and natural resources conservation program. If you go over to the top right, you got the executive order 14008, tackling the climate crisis at home and abroad, sort of overview. So that was, again, released in January. So the emphasis here is on national security, climate mitigation, or energy and sustainability, climate adaptation, and environmental justice. And the deliverables that we worked on here at OSD were the climate risk assessment and the climate adaptation plan. So I'll touch on both of those later in the presentation. If you move to the bottom left, this is examples of where climate data, tools, and guidances are being input into the planning processes. So I won't read through those first four, but those are sort of the installation planning processes. The last one right there, the unified facilities criteria updates. So several of these have been updated over the past few years. I'll name a few here. So we've got UFC 2-100-2, which is installation master planning. So that included updates for energy and climate resilience as required by the 2021 NDAA. Then we've got some landscape architecture, civil engineering, and high performance and sustainable building UFCs. And so again, those were requirements were recently updated to incorporate climate change and climate resilience into those. And then those bottom three right there are some service. So the Army Climate Resilience Handbook, the NAVFAC Climate Change Planning Handbook, in the Air Force Planning Handbook. So this is sort of where climate data is already being incorporated into the planning and implementation within the three services. And then lastly, in the lower right-hand corner is the DoD Climate Assessment Tool, or DCAT. So that is a department-wide tool that is currently being used to provide screening-level exposure assessments to guide further studies where mission and operations may be exposed to climate hazards, as well as the resulting investments in resilience measures to reduce risk. So it's actually consistent with the language of Section 326 of the FY 2020 NDAA, development of an extreme weather vulnerability assessment and tool. So, and I'll go into further detail on the DCAT later on. Okay, so first I'm gonna talk about the climate adaptation plan. So again, that was spurred by EO 14008, Section 211. The idea here is that climate change is a crisis and agencies need to respond to it as it is a crisis. So that sort of was the, you know, marching instructions out of the executive order. So the plan was drafted according to the requirements outlined and coordinated across the department. It was signed by the Secretary of Defense on the 1st of September and released by the White House October 7th. And so the top line messages are listed right there, those three bullets. Climate change is a serious threat to our security. It impacts our missions, plans, and capabilities and must be met by ambitious immediate action. That second one, again, we see adaptation and mitigation. So the department is responding to climate change in two ways, adaptation and mitigation. We must do both. And then finally, the department is taking bold steps with its plan, which is intended to drive transformative change across the entire department. And it really starts with a bold policy statement that really showcases how the department is willing to put climate change first and foremost. And so there is a Climate Spotlight webpage that is constantly updated with stories from across the department and where many of these reports, including the climate adaptation plan, can be found. And the link is there on the screen. Okay. So this is the strategic framework that is in the climate adaptation plan. There are five lines of effort, which you can see there on the left. Climate-informed decision-making, train and equip a climate-ready force, resilient built and natural infrastructure, supply chain resilience and innovation, and lastly, enhance adaptation and resilience through collaboration. So these LOEs, or lines of effort, lead to the strategic outcomes, which are shown that middle right section. And they all lead to that end state over on the far right, which is to ensure the DoD can operate under changing climate conditions, preserving operational capability, and enhancing the natural and man-made systems essential to the department's success. that is our overall end state for the department as outlined in the climate adaptation plan. Each LOE has four focus areas that are described in the CAP. And then there are also these four enablers, which you can see right there in the middle, that support and integrate across all five of the LOEs. And they're throughout the plan as well. And those four enablers are continuous monitoring and data analytics, aligning incentives to reward innovation, climate literacy, and environmental justice. Okay, so this is the companion document that the department released along with the climate adaptation plan. It was released the 4th of November. It's also up on the Climate Spotlight. It's a companion document which highlights the department's past successes and ongoing initiatives to address climate change considerations in the department's plans, strategies, operations, and infrastructure. So there are really great images and project descriptions in this document. However, I will note that it represents just a few examples from a larger compilation of adaptation efforts across the department. And it is aligned with the structure of the CAP. So the examples cover those five lines of effort that I just mentioned. Okay, next is the Defense Climate Risk Analysis, or DCRA, which is also required by Executive Order 14008, but this was Section 103. So it was actually prepared by the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. We did have a hand in reviewing it, however. So it was coordinated again across the department, signed by the Secretary on the 9th of October, and an unclassed version was released by the White House on the 21st of October, and it's also available online and at the Climate Spotlight page. So the top line messages are again below here. They're similar to the climate adaptation plan, but really stress the security and intelligence aspects of climate change that impact the department's planning and strategies. And so those are, DOD will play a key role in many security scenarios, which will be influenced by climate change. Climate change, as we know, has direct risks, but it also has compounding risks. And so those risks may not just be other climate risks, such as, for example, storm surge and heavy precipitation happening at the same time, but they also could compound with, say, economic disruption and extreme floods. So we've seen that this year. We've seen extreme heat and wildfires, which has caused an increased health effects across the West. We've seen extreme heat and hurricanes. You know, after Ida, there was a heat wave that added to the death toll there. So these compounding risks. And then lastly, climate will be incorporated into relevant strategy, planning, and processes throughout the department. Okay, and so with that, hopefully Carrie can unmute, and I'm gonna hand it over to her to sort of talk about mitigation and the sustainability program. Okay, great. Hi, Carrie.
Yep. Hello. So as both Carlos and Alicia said, we really can't do any of this without working adaptation and mitigation together. Adaptation does have a very strategic goal of a short-term or a near-term impact or affecting the impacts of these climate hazards. And so when we think about how, I mean, this is a remediation group, so it's not hard to think about how we would address a potential hazard or a potential risk. But what we're looking at with mitigation is really understanding how those actions may also affect greenhouse gas emissions and our mitigation efforts. So when we perform an action, we also have to keep in mind that sustainability side of what we're doing. And so we go back, and Alicia started with the structure. So I'm going to start with the structure too. But we have this series of executive orders. And if we read them in order, they sort of set us up for a program or for an assessment or a system to help us understand where we're going with mitigation. So I encourage you to think of it that way and look at what these different executive orders are doing in terms of greenhouse gas related mitigation. All right, go ahead, next slide. So if we look at the first one, it's focused on that social cost of carbon. And that really helps us understand what we're going to be spending. You can click through it because I think there's some animation of what the different supply chains may impose and how that relates to what we're spending for our different activities and our procurement. So that's one piece that we have to think about. Go ahead and move forward. And then 14,008, that's where we really started with that adaptation plan. But we've also looked at it from the term from the greenhouse gas side, and driving our purchasing power and driving that innovation. We have this directive to get to the net zero emissions economy wide by 2050, and it's looking to the federal government to help drive those assessments and disclosure. We see this word disclosure here, but there's not really a lot of fidelity to how that's described. We go to the next EO. So we're looking at how our supply chains are reporting their different risks associated with climate efforts. This isn't just our you know, planes and trains and our ships that we may build, but we're looking at, you know, food supplied to our troops and the energy required for different activities that we may be performing for remediation. So this is understanding how these supply chains, you know, we have to use the tractors and the backhoe for some of our remediation. Where are they getting their gas, and how is that going to affect all of our costs for all of our activities and those supply risks? So we're looking at that. We're trying to understand it. Move forward. And then we have the 1430, and this is where our suppliers are actually being directed to disclose greenhouse gas emissions, encouraged to understand their financial risks and set goals. So now we put all of these things together, and we have this hope. We keep looking forward to our final executive order that's really going to hopefully describe how these clean energy and industries are going to create jobs and federal sustainability. So that's still in draft. We keep looking forward to that coming out and drive that sustainability side of our plan. Go ahead. Oops, I'm not really sure why it went blue. Yeah. I think that was a highlight from a previous presentation. It was the wrong color, though. Okay, so this is really this framework on the sustainability side. And if you look in that lower left-hand corner, again, we see that overlap with adaptation and resilience. And we have these cross-cutting goals with public and private partnerships and the sustainability of human capital and environmental justice. So all of these things are very similarly structured so that the two dovetail nicely, and we've got mitigation working very hand in hand with our adaptation strategies. Go ahead. And just to mention on that last slide, that is in draft final. OMB's been looking at it, but given the potential release of the new executive order that may change things, I'm not sure if that will ever get released. Just to make that note, we thought we would have it released way before now, but I wanted to put it out there as a structure and a framework to start that we will be looking forward to developing further with our new directions. So what are we doing right now? We have set out a request for information looking at to our industrial partners. We've received over 20, 25, 28 responses. Some of them were pitching you know, what they can do, but some of them had some good data. Some of them had some really good information on how they have data sets or collected certain greenhouse gas emissions, and some of them have reported their own greenhouse gas emissions, whether or not scope 1, 2, or scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions are being reported, the methodologies. All of these are variables that we don't yet understand, and we really need to gather more information, understand those methods and those practices. We've also got FAR case studies, similar questions going out and requesting some information on some of those. And ultimately, we plan to do a baseline study, some pilot studies looking for supply chain greenhouse gas emissions and understanding how we might communicate and coordinate with our partners in industry and reduce those emissions and leverage those different practices and technologies within our ability to purchase clean services. And with that, I think there's one more slide or a couple more slides. There you go. And I'm going to turn it back over to Alicia.
Great. Thank you, Carrie. Yeah, so I'm just going to finish out talking about some climate resilience tools. So the two that I'll touch on, and I will mostly go through that first one, is the Climate Assessment Tool, or DCAT. So the Army Corps of Engineers developed the ACAT, or Army Climate Assessment Tool, which is a common access card-enabled online collection of scientific climate data to support research, analysis, and decision-making about the exposure to potential disruptions resulting from past extreme weather, as well as reasonably foreseeable climate impacts. And so OSD, or the Office of the Secretary of Defense, funded the expansion of the ACAT tool in fiscal year 2019. And so now we have the DCAT tool. And I will go into more detail on that piece in a little bit. And then the second one is the DoD Regional Sea Level Scenarios for Coastal Risk Management Database. It's called the DORSAL database. And so this is also a CAC-enabled database that provides regionalized sea level and extreme water level scenarios for three future time horizons, 2035, 2065, and 2100, for over 1,700 coastal military sites worldwide. So the database assists coastal installations with facilities planning to account for future sea level change. And so both of these tools support research, analysis, and decision-making at all levels of the department, and they illustrate the department's commitment to address climate change. And so I'm gonna spend the remaining time just talking about the DCAT and how the future work with this tool, I think, will be really beneficial for this group here and potential, you know, site cleanups and remediation sites. So what is the DCAT? It provides regional climate information and screening level assessments of climate exposure across 8 hazards. And so those hazards are coastal flooding, riverine flooding, heat, drought, energy demand, land degradation, wildfire, and historical extreme weather events. DCAT helps identify relative exposure of installations to climate hazards, which is the first step in addressing the potential physical harm, security impacts, and degradation in readiness due to climate change. There's two scenarios, a lower future warming and a higher future warming, as well as two time periods or epochs. So 2035 to 2064, which we have centered at 2050, and 2070 to 2099, reported at 2085. So an accompanying report, you can see the cover photo there on the left, is called DoD Installation Exposure to Climate Change at Home and Abroad. This was released in April of 2021, and it is also on that Climate Spotlight webpage. And it analyzed nearly 1,400 installations for climate exposures. Exposure is only one leg of the three-legged vulnerability stool and can be an effective tool at the screening level to prioritize further investment. However, a robust understanding of vulnerability includes sensitivity to hazard exposure and an estimation of adaptive capacity. Current work is being done to include that sensitivity and adaptive capacity to this tool. Some examples of analysis that we are doing currently are crosswalks with those climate hazards that I just mentioned, specifically flooding and permafrost. So crosswalking insulation buildings, for example, with flood mapping or permafrost mapping allows us to get at sort of, you know, percent of buildings that would be impacted by flooding at 1% AEP, annual exceedance, or 2% or 3%. And currently, you know, future work that could be directly applicable to this group might be doing crosswalks on these hazards with remediation and cleanup sites. So, right, so we could do the same sort of crosswalk with the hazard GIS data that we have and where those locations of those cleanup sites are. Currently, we only have installation boundary information for select locations. So a formerly used defense site likely might not be within the tool, but certainly future capabilities could include that. And we're hoping to expand the tool over the next several years to really get at some of these more sensitive areas and get to that adaptive capacity. So finally, the resources previously mentioned, so including the DCAT that I just talked about, the dorsal database, the climate adaptation, and other directives, they serve as guides for this climate-informed decisions for master planning, natural resource planning, insulation resilience planning. So this figure right here illustrates how one can use authoritative climate data and vulnerability assessments in that planning process, such as the real properties master plan or the energy and water plans or the natural resources management plans. And you know, in the future, that might be some of these remediation site cleanup plans. So the department has the tools, guidance, and expertise to really start incorporating climate considerations into insulation planning. Okay, so last slide. So sort of the next steps, we're expecting, as Carrie mentioned, that new EO, Catalyzing Clean Energy Industries and Jobs Through Federal Sustainability. We anticipate that it'll have additional targets and goals in the sustainability arena and an increasing emphasis on climate resilience. Over the course of the next year, the topics just discussed, again, the CAP, the DCRA, the SRIP, will link with energy and water resilience activities that are already underway, as well as CEQ reports on conservation, environmental justice, and other topics. And that will sort of be gathered into the next steps, which will be a DOD climate change initiatives implementation plan. And so that's sort of the focus of the climate team at ENER over the next year. And so with that, I thank you and look forward to any questions.
Thank you very much, Alicia. Thank you very much, Kira. Carrie, sorry. It was very helpful. This is Carlos. I'm going to turn my video on. Very helpful. Thank you for sharing that. And as we can all see, there's a lot going on. A lot of changes are happening. And we're all investing significant resources, not only in figuring out where we want to go and what we need to get there, but also actually developing tools like DCAT. And this is exactly the reason we wanted to have this shared conversation amongst you know, the federal family to see what we are all each developing, because we're definitely going to keep an eye out on what you guys are working on, because you know, the available resources that you can put to working on some of these tools such as DCAT. Let me check with Jean. Is there any question from the audience that we want to take, or
yeah, Carlos, we did have a question that came in, and this one was actually asking about DCAT, and they wanted to know if it's going to be made available to others to use anytime soon?
That's a great question. Currently, it's you know, internal and CAC enabled. We are looking at, so one of the POTUS deliverables and Secretary of Defense deliverables from the Climate Summit back in April was to look at partner sharing of the DCAT tool with partner nations. And there were five of them. And I'm going to not remember them all. Japan, UK, Germany, Spain, Italy. Sorry, I can get you that exactly. So the point is, so we're working on an analogous tool for it to meet that deliverable in April 2023, for sharing in, you know, across the federal government. I think that those plans in something similar, once we have worked out sort of what a partner nations sharing tool might look like, would be, you know, sort of the next steps. So I see that in the future, but nothing immediate.
Okay, and then just one other question that's come in. Somebody wanted to know if the climate assessment tool also looked at potential climate change impacts on CERCLA remedial actions in place.
No.
Okay.
Carrie, you look like you.
Yeah, no, the CERCLA sites are not. So the way the DCAT is currently oriented is it's focused on the boundaries associated with installations. So the CERCLA sites that may be outside of those boundaries are not included. I mean, if there's a CERCLA site that might be on an installation, we could probably add it to the DCAT, but I don't we don't have CERCLA as a as an input factor.
Okay.
Or CERCLIS.
Okay. All right. I think Carlos, perhaps in the interest of time, maybe we'll move on to the next item in the agenda.
Perfect. Okay. And if I can move this off. There we go. Okay. So thank you. So the question that was just asked is very appropriate to the topic I'm going to talk about. I'm going to bring it down, narrow it down a little bit further to the question of Superfund. We saw this question earlier about climate in the agency and climate in the remedial project manager. That question was very relevant. The question is, how could DCAT, for example, be used to determine the vulnerability of a remedy that may be at a federal facility? But let's assume it's anywhere. It doesn't really matter where it is. So the question here related to CERCLA, which came up as well, the Comprehensive Environmental Risk Compensation Liability Act, which is basically the Superfund law, and a national contingency plan where it's played out. And, they have the fundamental basis for considering climate. Now, you won't find climate in CERCLA. However, one of the criteria for selecting a remedy at a contaminated site is long-term and short-term protectiveness. So if we are selecting, building, or operating a remedy that will get washed out in a severe weather event down the road that we can foresee is coming, we will not be consistent with CERCLA or with CERCLA or the 9 criteria for the NCP. Hence, the authority is there to ask questions about climate and how it might affect the protectiveness of a remedy. When to do that in the CERCLA process, it's never too late or never too early to assess vulnerabilities and mitigate effects that those may have on the protectiveness of a remedy. For example, early on in the remedial investigation feasibility study, we've got the nature and extent of contamination. So we already, of course, look at that. Where would it affect the climate? The question is, how might climate be different in the future, and how might it affect the nature and extent of contamination? Same with any resulting human and ecological risk from the presence of that contamination and exposure pathways, as well as remedial alternatives, development and screening. Let's not develop an alternative that is not going to provide protectiveness given the future climate scenario. All that plays out in remedy selection ultimately, of course, as well as remedy design. That's where we quite often find an opportunity. The change required is maybe adding some resilience. It's not completely doing away with the remedy, but it's adding resilience in the design, construction, operation of an existing remedy. Hence our remedy action. If it's already underway, what do we need to do, particularly given potentially short lifespan of some remedies, to ensure that it is resilient? Often this has something to do with site management plans. Let's be sure that we have the capacity to respond to a specific severe weather event that could be anticipated in this region. And then post-construction. So the 5-year reviews, unfortunately, often we do have to leave waste in place with some institutional controls, some engineering controls, or, for example, CAPS, et cetera. We have to ensure that we are asking questions about the continued protectiveness of those components. There is, in the 5-year review process, a question. Has any new information become available that would question the protectiveness of the remedy? And that, it doesn't say climate change on it, but obviously that very specifically refers to climate change. If we have been able to conduct a forward-looking climate analysis downscale to our site, and there's an indication that there is that some parameters are going out of the tolerance limits of our remedy, then we're gonna have to go in and do something to add that additional resilience capacity to it. Wanted to point out an important point here, the existence of the Superfund framework for community involvement. It's a really valuable channel to address the environmental justice questions at sites that may be vulnerable to severe weather and climate impacts. That is part of the Superfund process. It's required in CERCLA and the NCP to have a community involvement and have the community, provide the community an opportunity to be involved in the decision-making process. Now, if they are not fully aware or informed of the potential or knowledgeable of the potential impacts that climate may have on exposure, on contaminants, on remedies at their site, they're not fully participating. So that channel is an opportunity to ensure that they have an understanding of how climate is changing in their communities. So when they engage with the agency, they are fully informed and they can contribute constructively to the decision-making process. I did want to point out that in the Superfund program back in 2017, was a very active hurricane season. There were three major hurricanes that hit the southeast. I think most of them were reached at some point category 5. And there were 445 sites in regions 2, 4, and 6. That's the Caribbean, the southeast, and Gulf Coast that were affected by those hurricanes. We found that 251 of those sites were exposed to tropical force winds or higher, and 63 experienced flooding, 62 of which also had tropical force winds or higher. However, the important point is that only 17 sites reported minor damage, and none indicated that there was an impairment to remedy protectiveness. We did look more closely at documents associated with the sites and found that 42 of the sites of 42 of the impacted sites, 31 reported resilience design measures or preparedness actions. And that's probably, that explains how they were hit, yet the protectiveness was not impacted. Note that loss of grid power was a widespread issue in many sites. And the lack of capacity to start the systems back up down the road resulted in some damage to infrastructure on site that had to be replaced. So a key finding is that while the state of the remedies is currently resilient under current climate conditions, our challenge for Superfund and TUS is staying resilient as climate changes continue. So let's be sure that we continue to be prepared and resilient into the future. To do that, we can go through the process site specifically that we talked about earlier. Basically, assess your system vulnerability. Look at the exposure, downscale climate information to the specific decision-making unit, and evaluate its sensitivity. How might our remedy components respond to or be affected by that change in exposure? The question, though, as always, is the delta. What is the change in climate conditions at the site? Because we already do consider climate conditions in our decision-making process. So given that sensitivity, having identified those areas of lack of or need to increase the resilience, we can identify and prioritize adaptation measures, put them in place, and then do a periodic reassessment. Again, we're not saying that we have to do this for every site retroactively. If there's a 5-year review coming up, for example, that's a good opportunity going forward. What we are seeking to do is build this into our operations so that this is a standard practice in the way we operate our sites. We are conducting some preliminary assessment pilot studies at several sites. I want to point out some of these tools. I'm not going to go into them in too much detail. We will have a chance to hear more about them next Monday. We're fortunate to have EPA's Senior Climate Change Adaptation Advisor to the Administrator's Office, Joel Shiraga, will be spending some time talking to us about some of these resources. But main thing to point out is that lots of these come from federal funded sources that are generating the data needed to feed into these tools. So this is readily available, reliable information that we are all tapping into. I'm sure there's some shared overlap with the tool that we just heard up from our colleagues at the Department of Defense. But another important point though is that whole idea that climate is actually already being factored into our decision-making process. So when we talk about climate change adaptation, it's not a big shift away from something we have not done previously. What we want to know is what does forward-looking climate analysis tell us about conditions at our site, and what is the delta over current conditions? So what is going to change? And more specifically, how does that delta, that change in versus current conditions, affect the remedy decision, site operations, et cetera? So remember early on, we talked about the RPM should be asking how a condition is going to change on my site going forward, and how are they going to affect remedy protectiveness. This is exactly how you go about doing it. You look at the change in climate and that delta, see if that delta is having an impact on your remedy operations, performance, protectiveness, et cetera. Certainly that second bullet, the screen assessment should be conducted at a site level rather than a regional level. That's where it starts getting difficult. And we're fortunate to have a really good speaker from the USGS after the break, who will be giving us an example of how that analysis is conducted for specific federal clients that they work with. Now, the level of detail involved in a preliminary assessment, it'll vary based on the complexity and nature of the decision that's informing. So if we're talking about, there's an indication that there is a sensitivity, and to build resilience then is going to require $10 million investment, we might want to spend a few thousand dollars doing a more thorough, in-depth screening assessment to determine that indeed that investment is merited. And a really important point, this last one I think is one of the most important ones, what we're finding is you will need expertise in climate analysis, mapping, GIS, and contaminated site science and engineering. We need that team together, along with the site team, to ask those questions, pull the data, and do an analysis of what the sensitivities and adaptation measures may be needed. Long arrow. So just a quick internal memo to let you know, many of you may already know, that was addressed from our office director and Superfund to the regional division directors across the 10 EPA regions in June of this year. It basically reiterates the key authorities that we just talked about covering climate resilience efforts. And again, they're universal to fund aid, federal facility, or PRP sites. It outlines approaches to ensuring resilience, including that framework we just went through a couple of times. It identifies tools and support available to remedial project managers. Again, it is intended mostly as an internal memo. And it defines the technical support that's available to the project managers to conduct vulnerability assessments. So to do that, we're expanding our existing optimization tech support to include a climate assessment tech support. That may be available within the site teams, within the regions, but is not always available. We don't want them reinventing the wheel. So that's why that support is being provided. The question we often get is climate resilience actually being built into Superfund sites? It is. These are just some examples. We have some write-ups on them, like Rocky Mountain Arsenal. It was designed for a 1,000-year storm, and that site was that the landfill cover was put to the test because they did get a 1,000-year storm on the Front Range a few years ago. And they were able to determine, and it did work, it did hold up. Pine Street Canal in Burlington, Vermont. Another good example is American Cyanamid. It was hit hard by Hurricane Irene, I think it was back in 2011-12. No impacts to rent effectiveness, but very expensive damage to site infrastructure. And afterwards, they basically elevated critical electrical instrumentation 5 feet higher than Hurricane Irene waters had reached. That's that picture there. You see the central picture. And some other examples, such as the Vandale Junkyard in Marietta, Ohio, designed to manage severe precipitation events to ensure slope stability. And that takes me to, since we're short on time, I want to touch on one question that I think is really, really interesting. And it goes back to some of the opening remarks we heard from DOD, and that is that concept of synergies in climate mitigation and adaptation in the actions we take to clean the contaminated sites. There are many situations in which we can achieve both resilience and mitigation. For example, renewable energy, supplying continuous power if the grid fails, while also reducing greenhouse gases that would be associated with grid source power, if it were thermal, et cetera. Another is carbon sequestration through revegetation. So there's a huge opportunity here at many sites, large and small, particularly abandoned mine lands in the Western United States and other regions. But basically what we're doing here is removing atmospheric carbon while immobilizing contaminated media in a resilient manner with deeper ONA horizons, very robust root systems that hold the contamination in place. So we're getting both mitigation and resilience. Another is stormwater control through green infrastructure. So protecting the remedy performance from getting washed out, basically, while also using low, no energy, natural processes to treat and conserve surface water. So anyway, these are some examples of some of these co-benefits we can get from resilience and mitigation. So let's keep an eye out for those opportunities going forward. So I think I went over just a couple of minutes, but we're at 03. And with this, I'll hand it back to our moderator, Jean Ballin, who will take us into the break. And I don't know if there are any questions, but we're kind of short on time, right?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Carlos. Thank you. I do just want to share one comment that came in, and that was from an attendee just noting that they thought it would be a good place to start at landfills along shorelines because they've started seeing impacts of sea level rise and monitoring wells there. So that was one recommendation that came in. All right, excellent. So I think what we're going to do now is take a brief break. We had hoped for 5 minutes. I think we're going to get two. So I'm going to go ahead and put up some brief agency announcements here on the screen. And again, we'll have a roughly 2, maybe 3 minute break here. So if you need to step away, get a drink of water, please do. Otherwise, you're welcome to stay connected. And we'll resume with the live broadcast here in just a few moments. All right, I know that was not much time at all, but we are going to go ahead and start to resume and regroup here to carry on with today's FRTR meeting. I don't want to get us too far off the agenda. So on our agenda, following that very brief intermission, will be our agency debriefs on efforts and guidance to build resilience into cleanup programs. I know that there will be a number of panelists joining us to participate in this, so I'm going to ask all of my panelists to go ahead and please turn on their cameras so I can confirm that we have everybody seated around our virtual table, and we can go ahead and commence with the agency debriefs. So I'm starting to see a series of visuals come on the screen. I'm going to go ahead and start adding individuals to the spotlight so we can get started with this part of the agenda. And according to my notes, I believe we're going to start with Carrie Meyer from the Army Corps of Engineers. So Carrie, feel free to begin. Oh, it looks like you're still muted, Carrie.
I double mute myself, so That's my own fail safe. So I was going to say I was going to be really fast, but sorry, I took a little 30 seconds. I wanted to just briefly go over our process. I mean, there are a couple of things that we're doing at the Corps of Engineers, and we are looking at, we have a USACE climate action plan, and that's focused on a lot of civil works activities. And that's really has a lot of our adaptation measures that are engaging in flood risk management and some other processes. But we are looking at these executive orders coming out and particularly how that affects our supply chains, how that affects our construction you know, we have a lot of military construction in our house. And so how does that affect our building structure and our materials that we're looking at? That is pairing, very, very closely pairing adaptation measures with our mitigation strategies. And so our BCOES process, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but we have a biddability, cost, operability, OE, environment, and sustainment. So all of these things are checklist factors that we have to consider when we're designing any of our buildings. And we've really taken a good hard look at that with this new executive order and tried to institute some of those thought processes in our design structure. And so hopefully we'll start seeing that come out in our processes very soon. I don't know if there are any other questions. There you go. That's the Department of Defense matrix. So now I'm on Army is not on there. Or maybe you're not showing the Army. There we go. There we go. And so if you have, if you need those resources, I'm sure this is being sent out, correct? This was part of our...
Yes. So this resource is already available to download from the seminar resource area. And I will put that link for everybody in the chat.
Thank you. All right. If there are no questions, I'll just turn it over.
Ken Glover from the Air Force,
you're next, please. Yes, this is Ken Glover. I'm Air Force subject matter expert. That's me for remediation. I'm located here in San Antonio with the Air Force Civil Engineer Center. And is that working better now with the mute?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Okay, fine. Anyways, recent experience at the Air Force installations, a number of installations, driven home the need to address remedy resilience and sustainability, particularly for complex sites, long times to clean up, that kind of thing. So we've had some severe weather events in recent years, hurricanes, flooding, wildfires that have had direct impacts. Unfortunately, or fortunately, nothing calamitous. But we've also had secondary impacts at a number of particularly Western installations due to changes in regional water use patterns, indirectly driven by climate changes, drought particularly, and they have complicated cleanup efforts with groundwater flow directions and plume migration pathway shift. So from that perspective, I wanted to just say a few words about what you're seeing on the screen here now. Air Force guidance and tools for evaluating and addressing risks associated with severe weather and climate hazard. The compilation here and that you can download shows two short overview articles or fact sheets on the left. In the middle, you see a link to the policy directive, Air Force policy directive, and two Air Force instructions for implementing that policy. And in the right-hand column, the AFCAC playbook, which was recently released. And the playbook describes a systematic framework to screen and assess severe weather and climate hazard and associated risks, current and future, at Air Force installations. It also explores how to integrate screening and risk assessment into project planning, infrastructure development, and so forth. So the playbook is now being used to integrate climate resilience into installation master plans. And to date, the emphasis of this effort has been primarily screening, assessing, and planning for climate and weather-related risks, vulnerabilities, mitigation strategies, principally for infrastructure that's at the installations. Application in a systematic way to the development, implementation, optimization of remediation systems and strategies has lagged. And so with this meeting today and next week, it is rather timely in our Air Force efforts to address cleanup resilience. And now I'll pass the baton to the Department of Energy and Albiz Gaon.
All right, thank you. Okay, so I do not have slides. But I will tell you real quick with what our efforts are. So up to say last year, all our efforts have been focused on meeting the requirements of previous executive orders, you know, through the last two or three administrations. All that focus was on sustainability, reducing greenhouse gases, energy use, water use, et cetera. You're probably familiar with all those goals, sustainability goals. And we made substantial progress on that. We reduced our greenhouse gases by over 60%, as well as becoming a lot more efficient when it comes to our energy and water use, along with other waste management, along with other other goals. But one of the situations that we have in our office, and for those who are not familiar with our office, is that I represent mainly the Environmental Management Office at DOE. This is the office that is in charge of cleaning up our nuclear sites, and therefore having responsibility for most of the remediation and cleanup work at DOE. So we have a situation whereby most of the sustainability efforts were on the facility part, or facilities part, and also some of the operations. But there wasn't a real effort in the remediation and cleanup areas. There was not a lot of commitment to that. No previous efforts, previous to me coming on board, et cetera. And because the requirements were not truly there in terms of that area of our work. We tried in the past few years, tried implemented integrating some of that work through a sustainable remediation. We made some efforts to integrate some of that into our cleanup and remediation process and programs. We were only successful to some degree. We worked with our contractors. And again, some efforts were made, we never truly fully implemented sustainability and or resilience into our cleanup and remediation processes, decision-making, et cetera. So that's where we're ideally we'll go in the future. So in terms of where we're going from this point on, we will be focusing on meeting the requirements of our CARP, CARP, which is our Climate Adaptation and Resilience Plan, which is the requirement from Executive Order 14008. As you may know, let me see if I can share a picture of that, our CARP. If I'm successful, fine. If not, it should not be a big deal, right? Okay. So sure, I was going to see it on my screen, but maybe I will forget about that for now. Anyways, so our adaptation plan was approved, and now we move on to implement it. It was only approved about a couple of weeks ago, and our CARP or CARP includes five priority actions. The first priority action is basically development of the VARPs. And the VARPs, V-A-R-Ps, are the vulnerability assessments and resilience plans. Basically, that action says we have to do VARPs at every one of our sites throughout DOE. So we're already moving on to comply with that requirement. And previous efforts, back in 2016, we also attempted to do some of these, develop vulnerability assessments with some degree of success. We had all my sites, five or six of them develop assessments, some level of assessments, and we're able to get an idea of whether they had some impacts or potential impacts, some potential risk at their sites. So that was a really, really interesting effort, but not a whole lot happened after that. The requirement was that we had to do it every 4 years, and now we're on the fifth year. And then the new administration comes, new orders, and now our new climate action plans. Therefore, here we are, and we're going to start with a new round of assessments. And also, DOE came up with a couple of tools to help our sites, our facilities develop those assessments. And I will tell you real quick about two of those tools in a minute. Let me move through the priority actions. So that was the number one. Number two action is basically to enhance our adaptation, mitigation, and resilience to climate change. And we will do that mostly. We have done that mostly through sustainability actions, and we'll continue to do that through the what we call our site sustainability plans. Every site and facility in the field has to develop an annual site sustainability plan. Number three priority action is the institutionalizing policies, procedures, etc., all throughout the department. So basically, truly integrate resilience and adaptation into all the work we do. That was not done, was done to a very low level in the past. So we hope that this time around, we're gonna be able to do this all throughout the department. Number four priority action is to provide tools, technical support, science, so that our facilities, our people in the field will find it easier to be able to meet all the requirements in the adaptation plan, resilience plan. Number five priority action will be to basically develop, deploy emerging technologies, climate resilience technologies. So we will probably develop some pilots at some of our sites. And when it comes to energy resilience, this includes potential pilots on a modular nuclear energy. So those are the five priority actions included in our climate adaptations and resilience plan that we will be pursuing. In terms of the tools, I was going to tell about the tools, two of them. So one of them is was developed by FEM. FEM is our Federal Energy Management Office. And it's called the TRN, the Technical Resilience Navigator. Basically, it's a tool on the web that includes a series of panels to help people plan for a climate resilience. It's available on the web for everyone, and I can always send that information later if for anyone interested, the TRN. The other tool it was kind of an open source software developed by a coalition, if I can put it that way, of some of our national labs, including Berkeley. And this tool and technical assistance, they are already assisting DOE in developing the assessments, the climate assessments throughout the department. So they have gone through probably over 100 sites, focusing on one of our office, the Legacy Management Office. The Legacy Management Office is the one that handles all of our sites after they have been cleaned up, and we hand them over to them. So they have gone through a lot of those sites doing resilience assessments, and they will continue to help the department with those assessments. I am not sure if they're going to be available to help other departments, but I can find out and let you know if that is the case. Mm-hmm. You know, in a nutshell, that's where we're going, and that's where I'm going to stop it. Only one more thing to mention in terms of our resilience efforts and mitigation efforts is our adoption of electric vehicles. The idea is to basically transform our fleet into all electric if that's possible. It's going to take a long time, I think, given the situation, but that is the goal. That's it. I'm going to stop there.
All right, thank you. I think we'll be moving on to Christopher from the U.S. Department of Transportation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I'm a senior environmental engineer with the U.S. Department of Transportation, Volpe National Transportation System Center, which is located in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I serve as a subject matter expert and senior technical advisor to the Federal Aviation Administration's National Environmental Cleanup Program, among other things. So DOT's stake in resiliency, we know that there are increases in heavy precipitation, hot days, and coastal flooding that are affecting the reliability and capacity of the U.S. transportation systems. And we're at increased risk of major impacts to roads, bridges, port facilities, and railways near our coasts due to sea level rise. Extreme weather events and high tide flooding can block traffic and would require rerouting of regional freight patterns. And drivers already log 100 million vehicle hours of delay every year from high tidal events. There are also societal and economic consequences of severe weather, which can interrupt the transportation system, disrupt the flow of supply chains, which, as Dr. Waterhouse mentioned earlier, can have disproportionate effects on vulnerable populations, especially in urban settings. And just thinking about the complexity of the intersecting transportation networks, aging infrastructure, dependencies on the energy and communication sectors, all of these can be compounded by climate change impacts. And DOT Secretary Pete released back in August the Department of Transportation's Climate Action Plan, which assesses vulnerabilities in the U.S. transportation systems. And it outlines priority actions such as incorporating resilience into DOT grant and loan programs, enhancing resilience through project planning and development processes, ensuring resiliency of DOT facilities and operational assets, and improving climate education and research on resilience. And several DOT agencies have been engaging on this topic for a while. Most prominent among those has been the Federal Highway Administration. So there's Federal Highway Administration Order 5220, which is transportation system preparedness and resilience to climate change and extreme weather events. The order outlines federal highways policy and responsibilities across a range of activities to ensure that risks of climate change and extreme weather events and adaptation responses are integrated into the project delivery and stewardship of both the federal aid highway and the federal lands highway programs, and some of FHWA's responsibilities. Built into that order are for them to identify and remove administrative regulatory policy barriers, encourage state DOTs and metropolitan planning organizations, land management agencies, tribal governments to adopt risk-based and cost-effective strategies to minimize risk and to provide assistance and development of guidance and other resources. The Federal Aviation has a desk reference. It's a complement to an FAA order on environmental impacts. And what the desk reference does is it provides explanatory guidance for how to implement the National Environmental Policy Act in accordance with the Council on Environmental Quality's guiding principles. And there's a section of the desk reference that addresses climate, a subsection entitled Climate Adaptation, which requires that project proponents include a discussion on the extent to which proposed alternatives could be affected by future climate conditions. Moving on to some of the key tools, a major tool resources used throughout the transportation community is the transportation components within the U.S. Climate Resistance Toolkit. And this toolkit helps users explore hazards, assess vulnerabilities and risk, investigate resilience options, prioritize, plan, and take action. And then the Federal Highway Administration, again, has a vulnerability assessment and adaptation framework since 2017, which is a manual that helps transportation agencies and partners assess the vulnerability of transportation infrastructure and systems to extreme weather and climate events. And it outlines a number of key steps on how to do that. There's another various reports out there. Federal Highway also has a report out titled Resilience Pilots, which is a compilation of basically highway case studies and best practices. Federal Highway also has a climate change adaptation guide for transportation system management operations and maintenance, which provides information and resources to help transportation system management operations and maintenance staff incorporate climate change into planning and ongoing activities. The Federal Transit Administration also has published a report several years ago, which provides some additional case studies of projects that they've funded in the realm of resiliency. And there's a few things pending. We're actually working at the Volpe Center to help FAA finalize a green and sustainable remediation guidance policy that will hopefully fold in resiliency in some way as well. And colleagues in another division within Volpe are working on a resilience and disaster recovery tool suite for the Federal Highway Administration. And I'll stop there in the interest of time.
All right, thank you. And I believe we have our next member agency. We'll go back to Carlos Pachon.
Yes, thank you, Jean. And thank you, Chris. And I know you guys are working on a case study for next week. Look forward to hope that we're able to find finalize that. I'm really looking forward because I know DOT is doing a lot of very interesting work. For EPA, I'll be brief. Just a couple of, since I've spoken too much today, but note that I'm with Olin, Carlton's office, and there are other cleanup programs. I'm specifically with Superfund, but all of us are looking across our vulnerabilities of all our programs, including all the cleanup programs, and assessing and updating the vulnerabilities we identified in 2014. So you can still find the EPA Climate Change Adaptation Plan in 2014. There's a matrix in there of vulnerabilities by program. We're currently updating that. We don't anticipate some significant changes, but I think there are some interesting additions. There may be some interesting additions coming out to it. And the agency plans, as are identified in the EPA plan, which basically says our program offices and our regions are working out their implementation plans, should be out in February. So be on the lookout for that. We're looking at our vulnerabilities and identifying actions we need to take to address those vulnerabilities. Also, a lot of focus on research needs. And our speakers after this session, we have two really good speakers on research. I have a lot of interest in hearing that plays out. There's research, of course, on the climate side, but also when it comes to contamination on issues, more chronic issues, such as contaminant bait and transport, some questions, for example, what happens when we have repeating saltwater intrusion? Is that changing groundwater soil chemistry or having a different ionic strength? The pore water, what does that do to contaminant mobility, et cetera? So there are some areas we want to look at more closely to see how climate in the slower, more less evident ways is affecting contaminant behavior and how we need to clean up contaminated sites. So anyway, that's all in working on its implementation plan, including identifying research needs going forward. We talked about the fact sheets and ARC-X, which are up there. Again, fortunately, we'll have Joe Chiraga, the senior EPA climate adaptation advisory administrator, will be speaking next Monday to give us more details about that. The fact sheets that we talked about that were released in 2019, updated, and we'll be working on updating those again as things are moving very quickly. And finally, the technical support to RPMs, the first pilot studies we're doing, part of the challenge is the scope. Where do we stop? Where is the limit on the scope of what we need to look at? That's turned out to be very, very challenging, not only the tools, but also the remedy components and accessory parts of the site. So that's one of the challenges that we're having. And again, I'm really looking forward to Ryan's presentation this afternoon. And that's all I have. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much. We'll be turning to Kim Brown now.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. Hopefully you can hear me.
We can.
Okay, good. So I'm Kim Brown, and I am a senior environmental engineer, program manager at NAFAC headquarters located in Washington, D.C., and I work in the environmental restoration program there. And I basically help write policy and guidance for our Navy RPMs, which are located in our regional offices throughout the country. And I'm going to wait a while before I talk about some of the policy and guidance that I've worked on. I just want to first start off with telling you about some of the three basic goals that the Navy has done on our sites and in addressing climate resiliency and climate change. And first, the first goal that we do is we identify and we assess the effects of climate change for each of our sites through long-term effectiveness, which I know Carlos mentioned earlier in his presentation. And we do that through as long-term effectiveness is one of the 9 criteria of the CERCLA process. So that's why we're doing it, of course, and that way on our sites. And we do that by looking at our remedy selection on our sites and ultimately during the 5-year review process on our sites. Our Navy RPMs will generally assess how the effects of climate change may impact their remedial actions on their sites. And these actions can be affected by various factors, as you know, as we've heard. Some are relating to sea level rise, changing weather patterns, and then even melting ice covers on some of our sites. Next week, as we mentioned, there's going to be a session 2. We're actually going to see some of the evidence of some of those impacts, because we're going to be presenting a Navy case study which will assess how a county's sea level rise and saltwater intrusion will infect a barrier impact on some of our Navy plumes on the site. So stay tuned for that. That's going to be next week, where we're going to be presenting that that actual case study from one of our Navy sites. The second goal that we look at is integrating climate change considerations across our Navy sites, and we manage the associated risks associated with that in our remedy decisions. And they're basically based on, of course, again, that the CERCLA criteria, and that which is we ensure that it's considering the climate change effects. Some of that, the way that we assess that is through our, and if you look at the what we have up on the screen here with our Navy optimization policy that we have, our policy for optimizing remedial and removal actions at our Navy environmental restoration program sites. We developed that quite a few years ago, back in 2012. And at that time, we realized that we definitely needed to have a companion document. So we developed a green and sustainable remediation guidance, which you also see referenced there. And that's where we feel that that's how we're addressing right now climate, or that's how climate resilience and change can be impacted. We look at environmental footprint reduction. We look at, as we've been talking about, greenhouse gas reductions, and we have a lot of guidance that kind of tells you how to actually address that on our sites. We actually have a tool that is mentioned there, the SiteWise tool, the most recent version, which actually helps you in looking at green and sustainable remediation, and helps you to see how you're going to minimize the impact from climate change. So these are some good references that you see here. I think you if you go to them, you'll get some ideas on how we're essentially using some of that to address climate resiliency. The third goal that we do is we collaborate with our stakeholders, which is what we're doing pretty much, which is why we really are glad that we're having a session like this to talk about what all the agencies are doing. We collaborate internally, both internally and externally. Our RPMs and our technical subject matter experts basically partner with others, and then we look to partner externally with our regulators, with, of course, EPA, as we're talking here, and with the states, to see what type challenges we have out there in terms of climate change. And we look to ensure that we're all working on a thorough and synergistic approach to try to work together to make sure that we're basically using the best resources and the best tools to make these things happen. So in summary, we identify and assess, we integrate and we collaborate to ensure that we're addressing it most effectively on our Navy sites. So that's it for me now, and I will pass it on. I think I'm passing it on over to USGS. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. My name is Tanya Gallegos, and I'm with the U.S. Geological Survey, or USGS. And USGS is a department, we're a bureau within the Department of Interior. So I'm also going to briefly discuss some USGS and Department of Interior activities related to climate. I'm not currently aware of any formal USGS or Department of Interior policies as yet that would be specifically applicable to site cleanups. But we do have quite a bit of activity related to climate issues. The USGS has a climate and land use change mission area that specifically focuses on making scientific contributions to understanding how Earth systems interact, respond to, and cause global change. We have also quite a bit of other research on climate adaptation, water sustainability, carbon sequestration, critical minerals for cleaner energy infrastructure, and also geothermal energy. And those are just a few of the research areas related to climate. We also have climate adaptation science centers, and these specifically fund scientific projects that generate research data sets and tools related to climate. And you'll be hearing from a speaker later on today from USGS, Ryan Boyles. He's going to talk about using climate projections for local risk assessments. So the USGS makes recommendations and offers scientific guidance, but we do not prescribe policy for the decision-making agencies that we support, nor do we prescribe which specific scientific methods or approaches must be used, because each situation really may be served by a variety of other or different approaches. That said, we do have two recent documents that have been released that may be of interest. The first one is an open file report released in 2020 by USGS climate team, the USGS climate team on best practices for using climate projections, and the link is shown there. The report also provides an overview of model-based climate science in a risk management context. In addition, it summarizes how USGS will continue to follow best scientific practices. And also DOI recently released a report last month, and this is the Department of Interior's Climate Adaptation and Resilience Plan. And this outlines how the Department of Interior will use science as the foundation for planning and decision-making related to climate change risks, impacts, and vulnerabilities. The plan commits the departments to major categories of adaptation actions, including promoting climate resilience lands, waters, and cultural resources, advancing climate equity, transitioning to a clean, resilient energy economy, supporting tribal and insular community resilience, empowering the next generation of conservation and resilience workers, enhancing climate literacy, and bolstering climate resilience in the management of sites, facilities, and supply of products and services. And I also wanted to mention the recent Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act is also providing a substantial amount of funding for orphaned oil and gas wells. And that's important for mitigating methane and other gases being released. And so with that, I will go ahead and introduce the next speaker, Heather Henry from NIH and IEHS. Heather.
Thank you, Tanya. So hello, everybody. I'm a program officer for the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. And I wanted to highlight some ongoing climate change activities. On the left side, have a link there to our Climate Change and Human Health webpage, which has lots of resources there, including a literature portal that has several publications related to climate change and human health. Also in the middle panel, in July, NIEHS released a request for information that closed in September, which is going to be used to help serve as a framework for the NIH-wide climate change research plans. And in fact, that plan will be, I'm going to put this through the chat, this will be presented in a public forum on November 29th. So while I don't have a lot to say right now, I would encourage people to tune in to find out where NIEHS and other NIH institutes are in terms of planning for going forward with climate change. Currently, there is a lot of research happening within NIEHS that relates to climate change. As a part of NIH, as you can imagine, much of it relates to human health and vulnerable populations, not so much the remediation side. However, we certainly do cover some research in that, and I'll be talking about that a little bit later. Also want to just highlight that a lot of the NIH efforts going forward are outlined in the HHS Climate Action Plan, which is another thing I'm going to put through the chat. And again, repeating what a lot of others have said, but identifying how important it is to reach out to vulnerable communities, especially environmental justice, with regards to climate change and its impacts. NIEHS, through the Superfund Research Program, does fund research in fake transfer of contaminants and how natural disasters could influence that, as well as some of the sustainable technologies that we've heard some of the others talk about today. And we also have a robust working group called the Disaster Research Response. And that's also another great resource for tools, particularly as it relates to IRBs and human studies and surveys that could be useful and utilized during the time of disaster. So I'll turn it back over to our moderator and thank you for your attention.
All right, thank you so much, Heather. I believe we're gonna go ahead and move on to the next item on the agenda. So Herb, I see you are there and on camera. Let me go ahead and add you to the spotlight and you can feel free to start sharing your screen if you like.
Perfect, thank you very much, I appreciate it. I'm on the agenda to give Heather a chance to collect her thoughts and get her slides ready. So she'll be back in just a minute. But in the interim, I'm pleased to be here joining you today. And what I'm going to do is give you like a 30,000 foot overview of what we're doing at CERTIP and ESTCP on insulation, infrastructure, and energy resilience. I'm going to sort of at least virtually introduce you to the two key people at our office that you might want to get in touch with some more details. And then at the end, talk to you about where you can find those details yourself on our website. So not all of you know who we are. So here's a quick introduction to us. I know our acronyms are relatively clunky, but we're in the Department of Defense, so I think that comes with it. The Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program is a congressionally mandated program. You can see from our logo that we're a partnership among DOD, the EPA, and DOE. And we're a science and technology program. So this is where we develop technologies for environmental problems of the DOD and the DOE. A companion program that's DOD only, is the Environmental Security Technology Certification Program. And this is what the DOD calls a demonstration validation program, where we take technologies developed in CERTIP or developed elsewhere, there's certainly no requirement to be CERTIP, and go to an actual DOD installation, demonstrate them in real world conditions and develop cost and performance data that we can use to move along to implementation. And we do that by definitely partnering with end users and regulators. We have many both state and US regulators involved with us, very successful program. So we organize ourselves into five program areas. Many of you have attended many of these roundtables, obviously more than I have, and you've seen up here on the top right, my colleague Andrea Leeson talked to you about her work in the environmental restoration program area. Today, because of the shift in focus, we're going to talk about, in the bottom left corner, the research, conservation, and resiliency program area, where we focus on insulation resilience, in addition to some lots of natural resources management topics that I'm not going to talk about today. And then in the center in the top, the installation, energy, and water program. which is in ESDCP only. So here's the virtual introduction. Tim Tatro is our program manager for insulation, energy, and water. Kurt Preston is the program manager for resource conservation and resiliency. They both have a very vibrant program. Here are their email addresses and their phone numbers. I'm not 100% sure that they answer their phone numbers because they're mostly working home like many people are, but certainly the email addresses work. And if you want some more details about some of the real high overview I'm going to give you on the program, please feel free to contact either of them or both of them if you want. So here's a little overview of Tim's Insulation, Energy, and Water program. This was started in ESTCP at the very beginning of the Obama administration. So as you can imagine from that timeline, it was mostly focused on renewables in those days. That was the time that a lot of installations, particularly in the West, got big solar arrays, thought about geothermal, started to really take a look at renewables. But as we've evolved over time, it turned out that we really didn't pay enough attention to the resilience part of this. We didn't really knit these renewable sources into a resilience plan, a microgrid on the base to take advantage of this as there were disruptions. Many places we have solar arrays that are just heating up resistors because we don't have anything to do with the power. So over time, this program has really morphed into an energy resilience program, which is, of course, exactly what we're talking about in this whole session today. And it's always been called the Insulation, Energy, and Water Program Area, but of late, we've really gotten more serious about the water. It's sort of an ESDCP. We have water issues sort of sprinkled throughout the program. Andrea Leeson in her environmental restoration program has some work on reclaimed water for use in forward operating bases. So there are places everywhere, but we're really starting to focus it down at the Insulation, Energy, and Water Program Area and look at resilience of our water systems on our installations. And Tim has put a couple of examples of projects he's working on recently. You can see this geothermal heat pump system, which is, of course, a pretty standard thing these days. A lot of people are starting to think about ground source heat pumps as opposed to your standard air source heat pump you might buy for your house. But this also involves storage. So where in the when you have excess coal, you pull heat out of the aquifer and maybe use the heat in the building, store the coal in the ground. Or when you have excess heat, you pump the heat into the aquifer, store the heat in the ground, and then you can pull it out and use it later. And then I've already talked to you about the whole microgrid system where we're trying to knit together all these renewables and get ourselves available to withstand an interruption caused by climate change or, as Alicia talked about in the beginning, maybe a multiple impact event where we have a climate change-induced storm with maybe some terrorist activity or maybe an economic thing. And so we're really looking at a lot of these multi-stressor situations. And then the resource conservation resiliency area, this my colleague Alicia did a really good lead in to me for this one, talking about the Defense Regional Sea Level Rise database. That's something that we put together in CERTA now 4 or 5 years ago. And that's really sort of how it's exactly supposed to work. We do some technology development, some downscaling, got a panel together for this project, do some demonstrations then in ESTCP, and then moving it out to the rest of the DOD for use. So we'll call this a big success. And you can see all the things that resource conservation and resiliency is working on these days, where they're going. They're expanding on this regional sea level rise stuff, looking at both coastal total water and projected water levels as they rise in the future. Now, to give you a more concrete example, these are sort of the motherhood statements at the top. Here's a more concrete example. These are our calls for proposals last year. We've chosen projects in FY22 to work on based on these calls for proposals. They're going through the approval process now. So Carlos, in one of his earlier talks, about three talks ago, made references to saltwater intrusion set of projects. And I'll just say as an aside, for each of these topic areas, we would typically choose 4 to 6 projects. So we don't put all our eggs in one basket. We also get some working together, a team going on these things. So you can see in resource conservation and resiliency in CERTA, they're looking at saltwater intrusion impacts. In ESTCP, we're trying to help installation managers pick out what climate model that would be best for their installation, given their situation. And then in insulation, energy, and water, you can imagine we use some 21 leftover money to promote this first one to effective planning for electric vehicle infrastructure because of the interest of the new administration to really move this thing forward. So it's one thing to go out and say, great, we're going to get the GSA fleet. It's going to be half electric by 2020, whatever it's going to be. It's a whole nother thing to be able to handle that at your installation. Do you have the infrastructure? How do you manage between the government-owned and the privately owned fleet during the day? How do you move them in and out? Do you try to use the fleet to store energy or do you not? So those are the kind of things we're looking at in those sets of projects. We've just started putting together our solicitations for fiscal 23. The CERTIP the solicitation comes out late in October, so just a week and a half or so ago. And you can see that Insulation, Energy, and Water is looking for innovative approaches for some of these related data and datum gaps in sea level rise. ESDCP is just under formulation now. If all goes well, ESDCP is going to see a significant increase in funding in 23 for these type issues. So we're getting a series of topics ready to go, and they will be released in early January. So each year we have a symposium. There will be sessions this year on several of those topics that I talked to you about earlier. You might want to go to our website, which is going to be on the next slide, and take a look. It might be interesting, something you want to look at the individual projects. And if you want to get a much more granular, much more detailed look at what we're doing, you may want to just spend a little time on our website. The URL's in some giant letters at the top that even old people like me can read. And I just rotator stop on a project of Kurt's where we're looking at wildfire impact on Alaskan forest. That's just an example of the work we do, and you can find any and everything we work on if you go to the website. And with that, I'd like to thank you all for your attention and appreciate your time.
All right, thank you. I think we're gonna move right along to our next speaker, Heather Henry.
Hi.
Oh, I apologize, Heather. I was supposed to introduce you at the end. I made a joke about it at the beginning and then I forgot. So we measured my attention span. I'm sorry. Heather's back.
It's my pleasure to thank you, Herb, for that great overview of the CERTIP ESDCP activities. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's happening at NIEHS, particularly within the Superfund research program related to climate change and resilience activities. And again, just to orient everyone, the NIEHS is a part, well, the Superfund research program is part of the NIEHS, which is one of the institutes of the National Institutes of Health. And we were founded under the SARA legislation with four mandates: assessing health effects and risk of hazardous substances in the environment, as well as developing detection and remediation technologies to mitigate and understand, you know, more fully the extent of issues associated with hazardous substances in the environment. So we have broad topic area that we cover. And we have a number of grantees across the country working within several different funding mechanisms. The funding mechanisms that are most relevant to today's discussion are the multi-project center grants and the time-sensitive grants. The multi-project center grants combine biomedical and environmental science and engineering, also brings in community engagement, research translation, data training, and can be basic as well as application oriented. And the solicitations go out about every 2.5 years. Another program that we have that's a monthly solicitation is a time-sensitive grant program that allows researchers to propose time-sensitive research that helps understand health consequences of disaster events when there's a limited window of time to collect samples or data. So by and large, the best example or the most related to our discussion today is the Texas A&M Multi-Project Research Center. They are developing tools and models to address exposure of mixtures during environmental disaster-related events. And they have four projects, two environmental science and engineering, and two are more health-related, as well as several cores that support the overall mission of the center. And again, of interest to those of you here today with a focus on remediation, the the two environmental science and engineering projects are looking at how disasters move path or change pathways of contaminants throughout sediments and soils. And the other project is looking at enterosorbents that can help reduce the risk of hazardous substances encountered during disasters. Also have very active community engagement core, exposure science core, and decision support, decision science core, all of whom work together to identify practical questions that are of interest to surrounding communities impacted by disasters. And it was not a month, I think, by the time this award had been made to Texas A&M that Hurricane Harvey hit a Category 4 hurricane. Over the course of 53 days, it raised the floodwaters and created massive amounts of fresh water into Galveston Bay, causing all sorts of flooding in the bayous and the waterways. And this created an opportunity for the Texas A&M Center to really dig into how these events redistribute contaminants. And in particular, have had a lot of excellent publications that have come out related to redistribution of PAHs, as well as other contaminants like mercury. They've had an opportunity to look at how well-characterized baseline data is and maybe make suggestions about where more baseline data is needed. And of course, you always need more baseline data. And then use of a novel tool that can help identify PAHs very rapidly. So it can be used as a screening tool should there be another disaster like what was encountered with Harvey. They've also been developing several tools that have been useful to identify areas of vulnerability and therefore help understand best methods forward for resilience. And one is the HGB EnviroScreen, which integrates data, health, environmental, socioeconomic factors to help understand where communities might be experiencing specific vulnerability and therefore which sector to address your plans to recover and improve the environmental health situation. Several mapping and modeling tools have been applied. These have been really helpful to identify areas where, you know, there's floodplain vulnerability, as well as identifying areas where green infrastructure can be used to help repurpose vacant lands, this to help be more proactive towards being more resilient. And also identifying how land use planning can really promote a city, especially your urban areas in terms of potential sea level rise. As I mentioned previously, the Texas A&M Center has a very strong community engagement core and has been working very closely with communities, not only in terms of citizen science for sample collection, but also for being very proactive in developing new planning that the communities had input into to think about ways that they can change their built environment to be less vulnerable should another disaster come. And so there is ongoing research in some of our other centers. In particular, the Northeastern Center has a longstanding program out of Puerto Rico, and they've been looking at health effects of contaminants on preterm birth, but having that large infrastructure there already in Puerto Rico, they were ready to help make an assessment of how Hurricane Irma and Maria impacted the sewage system, drinking water supply, and also surface water. And they have a continuing project that is going to be looking at the effect of extreme weather events on contaminant mixtures in karst water systems. We do have a time-sensitive research grantee who did some work in Puerto Rico also after Hurricane Maria on the other side of the island, Guanica Bay, looking at redistribution of PCBs, particularly in fish, and seeing if the levels were of concern for human consumption. also very much engaged with the community there. And then there was a hurricane that came through North Carolina that brought together several grantees to conduct a non-targeted analysis and understand flooding, distribution of contaminants after flooding. Another project that Duke has undergone is related to Hurricane Florence was with regard to a GIS tool that they developed. This is in association with some of their community engagement activities, but it was to overlay contaminated sites, floodwater, and also areas where people either have farms or community gardens and were concerned about what vulnerabilities might come from that. Another couple of examples, New Bedford Harbor has a model for predicting vulnerable communities, and so does California Drinking Water Tool, which especially finds areas in environmental justice communities that might be vulnerable for drinking water scarcities, particularly in drought situations. Other research that has to do with sustainability in arid conditions, whether that's planting, one of our panelists spoke about earlier before, also technologies that can be used in water stressed regions, as well as some basic science understanding how plants can survive in these difficult conditions. And a couple of products related to community interactions, a three-part webinar series that was released by Boston University, and another best practices for gardening after flooding. So two things to check out there. And this was a 30,000 foot view, so really focused in on the Superfund research program since today's topic is about remediation efforts. But I do want to make sure I don't forget to talk about all the many activities that are happening at the NIH and Department of Health and Human Services level. The Climate Action Plan was released in September for HHS. They also have a new Office of Climate Change and Health Equity. On the 29th, NIEHS will be hosting an NIH-wide climate change and health concept. So that will really lay the ground down for our vision ahead for understanding what research needs there are and gaps. So I encourage people to tune into that. And then we do have an ongoing disaster research response network, as well as several web pages related to climate change. And those resources are listed to the right there. And with that, I will pass it off. I don't know, Ryan, am I introducing you? Ryan Boyles is our next speaker, and I'll stop sharing. Make that possible for you.
Thanks so much, and thanks to Dr. Gallegos and Dr. Carlos for inviting me to give this presentation. I was not familiar with this roundtable group, so it's been interesting to learn and to hear how other agencies are trying to incorporate climate change into their longer-term planning. I'm here today to talk a little bit about how we do it from the perspective of interior, where a lot of our resources also have this long-term component there, but there are some short-term adaptation things we're looking at as well. I'm Ryan Boyles. I'm a climatologist. I've spent most of my career helping other disciplines utilize climate information and climate science in terms of incorporating them into how they do their science and how they do their resource management. The climate science, climate adaptation science center is a relatively new enterprise. We're about 12 years old. And we largely exist to support the Department of Interior and its state and local partners around managing for adaptation for fish, wildlife, and ecosystems. Right? So the core clients in the interior are the Bureau of Land Management, Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service, and then of course their counterparts in the state agencies as well. And in particular, what we're focused on is trying to understand both the exposure, the nature of the change that's going to be happening, trying to refine that to reduce the uncertainties, then also thinking about how do we move that into understanding the impacts to ecosystems. And then where we ultimately are trying to push the conversation is then, okay, if you understand the exposure and the impacts, what do you do about it? How can you adapt? Which strategies are more effective than others And we do this in pretty close collaboration with our management agencies, where the resource managers are actively participating in the creation of the science, the delivery of the science, and the incorporation into their world. This involves a combination of folks, combination of aspects from basic training all the way into things like decision analysis. So we've got multidisciplinary approach that we're attempting to bring to the table. And part of that is that we're hosted by regional university consortia. So we have university partners in addition to our USGS scientists that we can tap into to deliver the sort of the science that's most useful to a resource management across all the different scales, from individual place-based challenges for, let's say, a national park or a wildlife refuge, all the way up to regionally and national scale problems. And in particular, when it comes to climate change, we think about how do we deal with this at regional scales. There are climate models that we utilize that really get us down to very local, and I'll talk a little bit about that. We start off looking at global and national. So what I want to talk to you a little bit today about is sort of the process we go through, the things we consider, and so what we talk about are some of the best practices. Tanya Gallegos gave a link earlier to the sort of the best practices document that we're encouraging folks in Interior to use. You may find that useful too. But I'll go through some of those things today and give you a little bit of a primer. So what climate models are useful for and what they're not useful for and when they are most useful. And a lot of this, when we think about a risk assessment, it comes down to sort of the nature of the risks that we're trying to assess, right? Are we looking to estimate the risk of a boardwalk that could be rebuilt for a few thousand dollars or the risk of a species becoming extinct? And the way we tend to break this down, and I saw this in some of the chats, is, you know, what's the probability of this occurring? But the challenge is, and with the climate models in particular, that's along sort of the idea of what's the probability of an event happening? What's the prediction? What's the probability of it being, of exceeding this level at some point in the future? And that's a less complex way of looking at it, but it creates some challenges. Instead, what we encourage is scenario planning type of approaches, which allow us to incorporate a range of much broader complexity, right? So with projections, you could say, well, if this happens, what would be the result? Well, if this happens, what would be the result? And what steps can we take to make us think about decisions and plan that are robust to multiple what-if scenarios? And that's really what the climate models are doing, right? We look at climate scenarios that say, well, what if humans do this step? What's going to be the resulting change in greenhouse gas concentrations in the future? And the international community has come up with a handful of those that we widely use. We can look at the what-if scenario of greenhouse gas emissions, what the resulting atmospheric concentrations are going to be. And then we can use the climate models that we have, these extremely advanced numerical models, to predict what the climate response is going to be to those greenhouse gas scenarios. What we can't do very easily, because all of those greenhouse gas scenarios are considered plausible, is then say, what's the probability of this model being right versus this model being right? That's not quite really what climate models are designed to do. Instead, climate models are designed to project how the climate system would respond to sort of perturbations in that system defined by those greenhouse gas scenarios that we talked about before. And this is an important distinction from things like weather models, which are more of those predictions where we can talk about what's the probability of precipitation over the next 3 days. The goals of those is to actually predict what the actual observed weather is trying to be at some point in the near future. But climate models aren't trying to do this. Instead, we construct experiments to simulate how the climate system would respond to some sort of change in the future. So we drive the climate system with those changes in greenhouse gas concentrations and see what the resulting change will be. And that's why it's considered a scenario-based approach. And while we don't talk about these as climate predictions, instead we talk about them as climate projections, okay? And we have multiple models that we use for every individual projection so that we have a global scenario of an ensemble of model projections for each individual emission scenario. And that ensemble is really useful. It's one of the things I want to hit home, because we want to make sure that the ensemble of models are collectively used by things like the planning that you may be doing, certainly in the planning that we're doing to support our natural resource managers. This ensemble of models is really important because what it allows us to do is to better characterize what that uncertainty a future change is going to be, because we can run the same type of scenario, the same type of model over multiple iterations to handle all the different subtleties, right? So what you see here is the change in minimum temperatures over the continental US for the winter time in mid-century as compared to that historical reference. That delta, that change, that Carlos mentioned earlier. And what you see is that they all get warmer, right? Some of them get more warm than others, but this better captures that range of potential change climate is going to be in the future. It's not a single prediction. It's a projection, a collection of potential predictions, all of which are plausible. So global climate models do a lot of things really well. They're incredibly complex. We're still limited largely by the computing power that we have available. They capture the global, the regional, the continental variations. A lot of the large-scale drivers in the climate system are really well represented. But climate models aren't perfect. And in particular, there's still a process that we struggle with, and that's clouds and things related to clouds. And a lot of this is because clouds, in fact, almost all of this is because clouds form at much smaller scales than we have the computing power to fully resolve. So you can think about other things that happen on very small scales that we can't fully resolve because of limited computing. We understand the physics behind this. We can predict it for individual or downscale types of approaches, but the global models aren't able to capture this, right? So think about changes in local topography. I give an example here of the island of Puerto Rico, and you can see what the number of grid points that are captured in a global model versus the actual observed precipitation variation or temperature variation over the course of the island, right? So complex topography plays a challenge. Representing some of those other, what we call sub-grid scale processes, the very finely scaled physics that we largely understand, but the computers just can't resolve them. So things like storm frequency, storm intensity, extreme events like tornadoes, the global models don't simulate those. So if we have known physics, but we know the limitations with the computing, so many of our impact studies really rely on us to be able to get down to this local scale. And so in response, climate scientists have developed a variety of different methods to sort of take the global scale information that's available and downscale it to higher resolution, provide more detailed information about climate impacts. There are a lot of different methods for creating these downscale products, and we don't have the time today to go into these. But importantly, there are a lot of important nuances in the downscaling methods, and the methods and the output subtleties are important, right? And we see in particular where we see model projections being misused, it's a lack of understanding of some of those important nuances. So understanding these nuances, understanding which are most appropriate to use in which situations is really important if we want to lead to good adaptation plans. So another thing I wanted to emphasize here is when we're using climate model projections, we really want to make sure that we have an established understanding between climate and what that impact is, right? So if we're looking at, let's use an ecosystem response, we're really concerned about how soil erosivity might change under climate change. We really have to understand what are the physical relationship between the rainfall rate or these other climate drivers and soil erosivity. What if you have different ground covers? What's the change? How does that change that relationship? So the climate projections that we have are really more useful when we have a well-established link between climate and whatever system of study. We have to make sure that we're considering the indirect impacts in addition to the direct impacts. And then, as I suggested earlier, we want to make sure we use a collection or an ensemble of projections. Now, downscaled projections are generally available in most situations, not everywhere, not globally, and they tend to be more useful than the global models. Not always, but in most cases. But choosing which ones to use, which ensemble to use, which methods to use, it can be tricky, and it's largely based on the nature of the study system that you have and the questions you're trying to ask. And I'll give some examples here to emphasize this a little more. So we're here is looking at, I picked a place sort of middle section, sort of coastal area. I believe this is sort of the Rappahannock area of Virginia. This is the change in the number of days with temperatures dropping below freezing, sort of mid-century as compared in this that future emissions level, that's the RTP 8.5 if you want the specifics. What a lot of people see, what a lot of products that are out there show is a single product, this multi-model average. And that's a single sort of average of all the different climate models that are out there. And a lot of people look at this and say, oh, this is what's gonna happen. In their mind, they interpret this is the prediction. In reality, there's quite a bit of spread. There's a range of model projections for the future that go from, you know, the multi-model average might be 41 fewer days below freezing, sort of a loss of a little, you know, 4 weeks of winter. But there's really a spread that's captured there. And it may be a loss as little as 3 weeks of winter or as many as 2 months of winter. We talk about the change that's expected in the future. This is all under the same emission scenario. All of these models are useful and plausible, give us realizations for what the future climate might be. This range of plausible futures, you could think about a range of uncertainty around this single emission scenario is something that we really want to make sure folks are capturing. Because when you think about it from a risk perception and risk planning point of view, what would you do if you had to plan for 21 days fewer winter versus 60 days below where it didn't get below freezing? The choices that you make may be very different, and you may want to think about, where's my risk profile? Do I need to be more sensitive to that extreme on either side versus just the multi-model average? And it's then also important, this is for that same location, but looked at decade by decade into the future. And you see sort of what's the model spread for both, in this case, showing the lighter gray is RCP 4.5, that relative concentration, that one emission scenario for the future, as well as a higher emission scenario. And you see there's quite a bit of spread there. It's not just a single value. And when you see a map showing this is what the prediction for what climate is going to be under this emission scenario, you know that there's already going to be some misinterpretation. It really should be, what's the range of predictions that are likely to happen, and how do I plan for that risk? Let's look at a precipitation example, because that one in many ways is a really more compelling one, but also a more challenging one to deal with. So this time I've picked upstate New York. This is the change in summer rainfall from a selection on average of about 20 different models downscaled. Again, looking at mid-century as compared to the historical past for that higher emission scenario, RCP 8.5. If you look at just the map, you go, well, it might get a little bit wetter in the summer. But when you look at the full spread of models, you see, hey, we need to be planning for not just a summer that gets a little wetter maybe, but what if the summer gets 2 inches drier? That's 2 weeks of rain, or 2 inches wetter. And so now you're looking for you have a better assessment of what the real risk is now. You can think about that range of future climates. So what remediation steps might you be taking that are robust to both increased wetness and increased dryness? Because both of those are very plausible. Similarly, you can see what that spread is. In this case, there's a lot of uncertainty as to what might happen in the future. And so to do effective risk assessment, you have to be able to plan for both the wetter and drier future. This gives you a sense of what some of those numbers might be for this location in the sort of blocks of decades into the future. So a few takeaways for your group as you think about this. Climate models are really a tremendous resource, decades of scientific understanding and mathematics and numerics put into this. They are our best understanding of how greenhouse gases are going to affect our climate. And they can be useful for assessing risk, especially when that model outcome is thought of not as a forecast, but a projection, one of many projections that are plausible based on our understanding of the climate system. And each emission scenario is that input to those models. It's a unique set of assumptions about what humans are going to do into the future. But you want that collection, that range of models, that should be analyzed, not just a single model, not just multi-model average, when you really want to understand what the uncertainty and the risks are. And the climate models are more useful when we have a well-understood linkage between the climate sensitivity and your system of study, right? Downscaled projections are generally going to be more useful. Choosing the right data to use can be tricky. And we saw an example earlier, some of the sea level rise stuff. We've heard Carlos mention earlier how they're using some of these data tools that are out there. We've done some testing. We find that actually a lot of folks who aren't specialists in the field misinterpret those tools and make the wrong choices. They use it erroneously, and then therefore their conclusions are erroneous. They just don't know it yet. There is no single best climate model. They are all plausible, useful realizations. Some do some things better. The model that's best at capturing the historical precipitation in the Southeast is the worst that does the historical precipitation for the Northwest. And some of them may be getting it right for the wrong reasons. Another reason why we want to use this collection of models is to better get a sense of where the risk is. We also want to make sure that folks are looking at projections that are relevant at climate timescales. The climate models aren't trying to predict what the high temperature is going to be on June 25th of 2062. It's not even trying to predict what the high temperatures are going to be during the month of June in 2062. The climate models are trying to predict, under a greenhouse gas scenario, what the high temperatures are likely going to be in the season of summer of the 2060s and 2070s. Right? So you have to think about what the climate models are designed to do so that you don't misinterpret their importance. So this document that Tanya highlighted earlier sort of highlights some of the things we were talking about here. But in particular, I think for the remediation group, as I understand more of what you're doing, you really are looking at those very long-term climate-relevant timescales, right? So you are concerned about those sea level rise issues, what the potential for irreversible impacts might be, and crossing over thresholds that might have critical change for your system. And this is all, of course, included in that open file report that Tanya linked out earlier. So with that, I think now I turn it back over to Carlos, and thank you so much.
Brian, thank you very much for finding the time to speak with us. You know, we're talking about climate change, and it's not till the very end that we get a climatologist. So, but thank you. That was very interesting. That's exactly what I was hoping we would hear. It's on the projection end. What do we know, or what should we be looking for in climate projections as to what conditions are going to be like at the site where we're making decisions going forward? So this was perfect. I really appreciate it. As you know, next week we're going to have a broader look at the tools that are out there. Again, from Joe Shiraga, in EPA, the lead advisor for climate change adaptation, and then a series of case studies. You've heard a little bit about some of them coming up, where we might be on the receiving end of that information, the depth analysis that Ryan conducts. So how does the receiving end, the team, how do they look at that and determine how they should alter their decision-makings, et cetera. But let me first see, Gene, if there are any questions in the chat that any of us, the speakers that are still with us can help address or.
Yeah, so there were a few questions that came in. And one of them was just talking about how climate change studies have been revising or perhaps impacting some of our monitoring strategies, particularly in the subsurface. So an example of, in another comment, that some of these projections could wind up indicating there'll be a change in freezing depth in soils and their duration, which would then change the mobility or remediation options for contaminants in the subsurface. So we were wondering if any of the speakers could talk a little bit about that.
Any volunteers?
Well, then we'll take that one back.
I will say that is a recurring question. I talked earlier about this work group across Office of Emergency Management, Global Solution Restoration and Reuse Office, Underground Storage Tanks, Corrective Action, Superfund, all the cleanup programs. We're on a group and we're discussing shared vulnerabilities. And actually, it's not an answer, but again, one of the questions that or ideas that came up is that we have put out a series of fact sheets on climate adaptation at containment facilities, at landfills, et cetera, sediment sites, because they tend to be very large, very expensive, and quite a bit of contamination that's in place. So we want to make sure we understand what the vulnerabilities are. The other one is the treatment systems, because there's often a large above ground, capital investment infrastructure to operate them. But two more that came up, one of them it has to do with monitoring, site assessment and monitoring. What do we know and not know about typical reasonably foreseen changes in our monitoring and how they might be affected by changing climate? So we've heard lots of case studies where the ground level drops so much that a lot of your monitoring wells are left hanging dry. You're not monitoring anything a lot of the year. Some of the year you're not. How does that change in those data gaps? What do they create as far as your conceptual site model? Or do you have to So anyway, there are quite a few questions. That's a really good question. We hope to start to address that in one of our next fact sheets, maybe related to site assessment and possibly monitoring. So that is a very valid question. I don't have a blanket answer for it, but it's definitely one that we encourage our site teams to be asking when they conduct their vulnerability assessments.
Okay. We also had a series of questions and just a number of people commenting that, particularly Carlos, in your presentation, they hadn't seen some of the tools that you were talking about in the presentation you gave, or they were unaware of some of the resources and tools that were out there. And so they wondered, is there a place where EPA, RPMs, on-scene coordinators, is there sort of a centralized place where these staff can go to find some of these resources?
Yeah, there often are. We haven't created one specific for Superfund, because one of the things I'm trying to avoid is recreating what has already been done and leveraging existing federal resources. We heard about what DOD's produced. We heard about what USGS has. Maybe after this conversation, we'll be able to pull together if there's a need for it. Certainly ARCX, the EPA site that Joel's going to speak about, I'm sure many of them are on there. But I also want to take the opportunity to emphasize the importance of having somebody with the expertise that Ryan has to help us interpret those, because those tools and what information is provided on them, what those projections mean. It's not any of us lay person can go in and say, oh, I'm going to become a climate expert and I'm going to download what the DC is going to look like in 30 years. and take that and plug it into the very, what could be a very significant decision. So I definitely encourage folks to make sure they have access to the right expertise when they are accessing those tools. Even though they're very easy to navigate and it's very easy to access information, interpreting and using that information does require the right kind of expertise.
Well, on that line of thinking, Ryan, I suspect this question is directed at you, so I'm just going to read it verbatim. The next generation of global climate model results, the CMIP6, are now publicly available and are based on a new set of scenarios. And they specifically wanted to know, does this make the existing CMP5 projections and the RCP scenarios and all of the climate impact analysis tools that were based on those models now obsolete?
That's a great question. So CMIP6 is out. We're currently, a lot of folks are working on downscaling those projections now. It doesn't make CMIP5 obsolete. What it does, those next generation models refine the uncertainty a little more, a little less uncertainty. It allows for us to better understand and better capture what the range of risk is going to be. It doesn't mean the old ones are obsolete. What CMIP6 uses is a different set of protocols for how it develops those scenarios. And so the scenarios in the newest round are not quite identical to the scenarios that were used in the old round. But over time, and this is what happened with each CMIP, with each IPCC report, we refine our understanding of where we're at now, what we're likely to see into the future in terms of plausible scenarios, and then we can use that to reduce the uncertainty as we move forward in the future. So the information that we gain from CMIP6 and the latest IPCC, it's additive. It's allowing us to further refine and reduce some of that uncertainty into the future.
Okay, thank you. Carlos, I know that we're coming right up on our scheduled end time of 3:30 p.m. Eastern, so I wanted to turn back to you to see if there's some closing thoughts or dialogue you'd like to walk through before I give the audience some final reminders.
No, that's it. I think we had a little bit of extra time here. I appreciate the effort, all the speakers, to be here today and to stay within schedule. I think we've done a very good job at that, finishing exactly at our scheduled time. Remind everybody that next week, as we've said, we'll be reconvening at 1 p.m. again. I think it'll be a very interesting topic. A set of presentations where everything we've talked about now, we can see it play out at actual sites. So I welcome you all to join us again next Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern. And I thank today's speakers for the substance, for the content, and for all the participants. I think we had a really good turnout, very well distributed amongst federal agencies, state agencies, consulting engineering firms, and others. So thank you very much, and we'll see you again next Monday.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Carlos. So with that, we'll go ahead and close out today's session. But before I let you all go, just a few quick final reminders. If you're looking for copies of the presentation materials, I know they were jam-packed full of important links and resources. We do have those currently posted on the seminar homepage. If you have any problems with any of those links, feel free to send me an email. I'll be happy to help you get the files directly. We also included links to the PDF listing of tools and resources that I was highlighting during our agency debriefs. So I encourage you to visit that seminar homepage. The URL is on this slide. It's active from today forward. You can certainly forward that on to colleagues that you think will find it to be useful to visit it. One other thing I wanted to remind everybody of is that on that seminar homepage, we do have a link to our feedback form. And the reason why I bring this up is that I often get asked for participation certificates. We do not issue CEUs or PDHs, but I can provide you with a participation certificate based off of your submission of a feedback form. So if you follow the link to the seminar homepage, you click the tab to the feedback form, fill it out, making sure to check this box at the very bottom, certifying you were here for the entire delivery. And then as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll automatically have a certificate of participation that you can save or print out for your own records. If you happen to have other people join you at your location who didn't register individually, you can share the link to that feedback form to those individuals. They can fill it out on their own, even though they didn't register separately, and they can still get their own participation certificate based off of their feedback. And for those of you who have been lucky enough to replay the recorded version of today's webinar, if you've made it this far, I'll direct you to look in the far upper right in the online version of our archive, and you'll see a button or link straight over to that feedback form in the archived version of our session. So you can still send in your feedback based off of your replay of the recorded session and get your own certificate. So this recording archive will be available in about 1 week, and then you'll be welcome to share that on with others who you think will be find this a valuable time to replay and catch up on what they missed. So with that, I will echo Carlos's encouragement to have you join us for part two next week on November 15th. And I want to thank all of the speakers, all of the organizers, all of the support staff, and the over 300 people who joined us from across the world.